Jack.
Call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, today we have House File. Oh, we have the Public Defender's Budget Presentation and one bill, Representative Olson's House File 400. So House File 400 has already been through two committees, so we'll be focusing on the areas within our jurisdiction. There is an author's amendment, and we'll be re-referring this bill as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes from February 14th? Representative Barcy moves the minutes from February 14th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of February 14th are approved. Public defenders, welcome to the committee. Presentation today, members, is from the public defenders. You can go ahead and begin by identifying yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. To my right is Bill Ward, the State Public Defender. First of all, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to come before you and the committee to talk about the public defense and not only the budget, but really kind of what's going on out in the field. So, just as a quick review, Mr. Chairman, I know we were here a few weeks ago on our overview. We are the largest user of the court system. We have 150,000 cases annually, over 9,500 cases on our appellate level. We provide mandated services in every court in every county and represent about 90% of the felony and gross misdemeanor cases and delinquency cases around the state, and more than half of all of the misdemeanor cases. As we mentioned in our overview, and this puts in context of the budget a little bit, is public defenders cannot refuse cases. So whoever is eligible, we have to take or our folks have to represent. The budget is about $88 million a year. As you can see from the chart, roughly 90% of the budget is personnel. Another six are what we call mandated costs. So those are things like rent, data lines, phones, computers. Those are the thing, you know, things that you need to operate an office. For the 2020-21 biennium, Chairman, we have...
Mr. Kyer,
yes.
Are there any mandated costs that we make you all pay that are like filing fees or anything like that that maybe private attorneys would have to pay that you would have them to pay to?
Mr. Chairman, there really aren't. The only one I can think of right off the top of my head would be our appellate transcripts. But, of course, the private lawyer would pay those right. as well if they were doing an appeal or in a civil case.
Right. So, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, as we've gone and talked to most of you, we've really been hit by kind of a perfect storm this biennium, I guess, in the last two and a half years. We have three critical areas where we are losing ground. First is caseload growth and staffing. The second is recruitment and retention. And finally, a legislatively inactive partnership with Hennepin County, which I don't expect that we're all going to understand after the end of today, but it is a major issue that we are facing. So the budget request itself is a little over $10 million the first year. And $21 million the second year. On this slide, you can see how it's been broken out or how we break it out into the various areas. First of all, the caseload growth and staffing. We have seen a tremendous increase in the number of cases over the last 3 years. Those of you who have been around a little bit recall us talking about in the last few bienniums, the one thing that has kind of saved us has been the caseloads have been increasing, but not tremendously. So we've had this kind of slow growth over the last number of years. That has changed considerably in the last 3 years. Our child protection cases are up 50% since 2015. Gross misdemeanors are up over 20%, and the felony case is up over 15%. You will recall that in the child protection area, we represent the children 10 years of age and older in those cases. Why is that, at least in the child protection area? First of all, there was the governor's task force on child protection, which changed the way the cases were handled or how they were going through the system. The second was McKenna's Law, which you all passed 2 years ago, talking about the representation and who and when representation occurs for children. And the third one is the drug cases, in particular meth cases. We've seen a tremendous increase. That is a big part of the 15% increase in felony cases that you all saw, or that we saw on the chart. In the area of the child protection cases, just to give you kind of a sample, Fox 9 News did a report back, I think it was in August or September. One out of every 10 children in Beltrami County was in out-of-home placement. I'm sure you've heard from your counties about this in terms of their costs and child protection about the out-of-home placements. Again, as I said, the children 10 years of age and older we represent. So the entire system is seeing a tremendous increase in growth in those cases. On the appellate level, we've seen the same kinds of increases. We have a 27% increase over the last 3 years in our post-conviction cases. Those are the ones that are at the trial level. Those are the ones where there's a change in resentencing or there was a sentencing issue. Evidence issues, there are a number of issues that come up for post-conviction relief. A 15% increase in the direct appeals. Those, again, those are the direct appeals from trials. Our public defender staffing, Mr. Chairman, if you look on the far left, it's the blue column, we are currently at 68.5% of what the state and national standards call for attorney staffing. Keeping in mind that these standards were developed in the late 1970s and our state standard was actually passed in 1991 by our board. As you can imagine, the cases have gotten much more complicated. There's much more scientific evidence, much more time that's required in these cases. We're dealing, obviously, with more mental health issues, more chemical dependency issues. So, again, we're at 68.5%. That red column, the 63%, is where we are looking at if, in fact, the growth in cases continues. By the end of next biennium, we would be at 63%. What we are asking for, and we'll get in a little more detail in the next couple of slides, is only to get to 70%, that green column. That's where we were in the 2016-2017 biennium. So we recognize that the request is a lot of money. But it really is a request where we're attempting to just maintain and stabilize what we have. So we're only asking to get back to those 2016 and 2017 levels. On our professional staff, again, we have the same issue. Roughly 63% of the legal secretaries we should have, 45% of the dispositional advisors, 57% of the investigator staff that we should have. Mr. Ward and I went to every district in a listening tour over last winter and into this fall. And every office we visited, every to a person, they mentioned the need for additional support staff. All of the lawyers did. They also obviously wanted more lawyers, and there was that. But every one of those offices indicated the need for additional support staff. Just to give you an idea of the staffing, we have 523 lawyers, if you count all of our lawyers and our managing attorneys. If you look at the number of paralegals, we have 17 to 1 ratio, 12 to 1 ratio for investigators, 7 to 1 for legal secretaries, and 17 to one ratio for dispositional advisors. Typically, I know some of you that practice, at least on the paralegal side, you probably in private practice look at one-to-one ratio, maybe a two-to-one ratio, something like that. So you can see we're at least with the private sector, we're way out of whack of where we should be in terms of support staff. What we're asking for, the graph on the left indicates what the request is. We're asking for 31 new lawyers the first year, an additional 19 lawyers the second year, for a total of 50 in the second year of the biennium. Again, that's just to get us back to where we were in 2016 and 2017. On the right-hand side, you can see the request for support staff. The pink kind of color or salmon color on the top is to support the new hires. The blue part of those columns is to support the current attorneys. What we're asking for to support the current attorneys is only to bring the support staff up to those same level that we are at attorney, so up to that 68.5%. But again, as we add new lawyers, as we add new attorneys, you should say there is a need for additional support staff as well. As you can see, the staff request is, again, while it seems a dollar amount is great, it is putting a dent, and only a dent, in our support staff ratios. Again, we're looking to go from, on paralegals, for example, from just over 17 lawyers to a paralegal to down to 14.5. So, again, it's not a tremendous increase in terms of the numbers of staff, in terms of the ratios, but it certainly would help. And again, we're trying to maintain and stabilize what we have. Recruitment and retention. This is one that has struck us in the last couple of years, and I think you've been hearing from some of the other agencies about some of the similar situation. But we've really, I don't know if we'd call it a crisis, but we certainly have a major issue that we are facing. You can see on this chart our resignation rate is just over 8.5% last year. Now, that's just resignations. That doesn't include retirements. It doesn't include people who are appointed to the bench, those kinds of things. This is just people who have come to work for us and then have quit. In all, it's 42 last year, that column on the far right-hand side. So far in 2019, we've had 8 public defender resignations. So in 6 weeks, we've had 8 people that have tendered their resignation. Since January 1st of 2016 until roughly the end of this legislative session, maybe a little bit before that, we'll have hired 174 new lawyers and 52 new support staff. It's about a quarter of our staff. What really is the problem, not only in terms of the time and expense of hiring people, training them in, is the loss of experience. And that's the chart that you see in the green. The lawyers have about, on average, about 5.5 years of experience. So we get the folks in, we train them, we get them to the point where they're doing good work, where they're doing efficient work, if we should say. Obviously, a lawyer that's got 5 or 6 or 8 years of experience can read through a criminal complaint a lot faster than somebody that's just starting out, right? We get them to that point, and then we're losing them. Tremendous institutional knowledge that we're losing. We did a survey went back and looked at the folks who are leaving. And by far the largest issue is they are leaving to go to employment in other public agencies, county attorneys, city attorneys. We've lost a few to the state. And what we're seeing is folks who are leaving not only to get a reduction in their workload, and we talked about the workload in the overview, but also more money. And this is just not a metro issue. This is a statewide issue. For example, our entry-level salary is $55,115. We lost a lawyer to the city of Rochester where she's prosecuting misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, so she has no felony case law. She's starting at $70,000. Beltrami County is now starting at over $70,000 a year. The city of Minneapolis, the city attorney's office, I think was $70,000 or $72,000. So it's, again, it's not a metro issue by any means. St. Louis County, Stearns County, I mean, I can go down the list. Washington, there's a number of these counties where our folks aren't making the same amount of money. And as I said, it is the biggest issue. Recruitment is the other issue, not only retention, but recruitment. The slide that you see here is just in the last 4 months, since October. We had a dispositional advisor candidate in the 2nd District here in Ramsey County turned down our job offer because he was making $20,000 more as a social worker at Regents Hospital. In the 3rd District down in Rochester, we had two legal secretaries who accepted their job with us and then ended up staying where they were or going, in this one case, going to the county attorney's office for $15,000 a year more. In the 5th District, we had 5 applicants for a job, an assistant public defender position. 4 of them weren't qualified. The last 3 times we went out for an assistant public defender position in the 5th District, we got 0 applications. In the 8th District, so that area, Wilmer and West, we had 2 applicants. One of them was from the Twin Cities, and he didn't own a car. I'm not quite sure how he expected he was going to get out to Litchfield or to Wilmer to represent our folks. In the 7th District, this is where we've had seemingly the most trouble. Again, we had 3 legal secretary positions where people accepted the job and turned it down. We had a public defender from New Mexico who applied, and our offer, our best offer, was $11,000 less than he was making in New Mexico. And we just had an assistant public defender from Iowa where our offer was $20,000 less than he was making it down in Iowa. So we're not even close in some of those respects. The number of applicants that we're getting, again, you can see on this chart, these are our greater Minnesota districts. We're not getting the applications. In the 3rd District, we're getting a few more. The 3rd District includes the city of Rochester, and so we do get a few more applications there. But in some of the other bigger districts, we just are not seeing the applications. For part-time defender work, as we talked about in our overview, about 40% of our staff outside of Hennepin and Ramsey are part-time. And we rely on them very heavily for this work, not only to cover all of the various counties, because we don't have a brick-and-mortar office everywhere, but also to handle conflict cases, because they're not in the same office.
One moment. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. You said you got 9 in the 5th Judicial District, but above you said, does that include the 4 that weren't qualified?
Chairman, Representative Constantine, the 9 was the average.
Oh.
So over the last 4 years, that's the average number of applications that we've gotten has been 9.
But they weren't all qualified then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Constantine, in that particular case, the one that I cited, no, they weren't qualified.
Chair Constantine.
Just wanted to clarify it. Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and members, for part-time positions, the situation is even more dire. Again, you can see down in the 5th District, we average about 3 applicants for every opening we have there. In the 8th District, 7. Again, in less than 20 applications for those part-time positions in all of those other districts. What are the issues? Obviously, on the salaries, we have a lower entry-level salary. We have a lower top on our scale. We have more steps than I think you will see we have 19 steps currently in our assistant public defender range. I think that's more than any of the salary ranges that you will see over the course of your work. and a lack of resources to allow people to progress through the scale. Remember the original, the first couple of slides we had, 90% of the budget is personnel, and we are mandated to take all of the cases that come through the door. So we have no wiggle room, if you will. We have no options other than what you all provide to the board for salary and benefit increases. We have no other opportunities or no other options. We can't leave positions vacant. We can't not cover counties. In fact, we do an awful lot of contracting to fill in behind people. So there really are no other options that we have other than, as I said, what the appropriations are. Excuse me. What we're trying to do, if you look at the slide in front of you with the various colors, the red color is where we are currently. I mentioned we're at roughly $55,000 for entry level and $107,000 for the top of the scale. We took a look at a sampling of counties, both metro and some from greater Minnesota, State Court Administrator's Office, and the Attorney General's Office, and that's the average that you see is on that blue column there. What we're trying to do is get to the green column. So we're not even trying to get, at least this year, to that blue average of where those all folks are. What we're trying to do is at least get competitive. This is the first step to moving our salary scales to be more competitive with other public agencies. So we're asking to get somewhere close to that so that we can at least get competitive, we can at least recruit and hopefully retain folks. So here's the recruitment and retention plan, if you will. And again, this is subject to collective bargaining. So you know, how it's going to all end up is anybody's guess, a year from now or 6 months from now. But here is what we have put together. I think you're going to hear from Representative the Teamsters at some point, either today or at some point, testimony on this budget request. But we'd like to adjust the salary scales to the level of the Office of the Attorney General and the sampling of those counties, so that blue column, if you will. We'd like to be able to adjust the salaries based on years of experience with the board. We had a number of years where we had no salary increases for folks, and so what has really hampered our ability to bring people in and bring people in with experience is we can't pay them more than what we're paying our folks who have similar experience with our agency, and so that's a real issue because those folks have not progressed through the salary scale. And finally, some kind of across the board or general increase. So that's what makes up the salary request. The other one is mandated insurance costs. I'm sure every agency that you hear from was going to have you look at the same thing. About a 3% increase in 19, a little over 5% that MMB is projecting for 2020 and 21. I do want to mention just briefly, Mr. Chairman, some of the other efforts because this came up in one of the discussions that we have. Money is certainly an issue with salaries for recruitment and retention. Some of the other things that we are doing is we actually have a management training session next week where we're going to be breaking our management team into smaller groups and talking with them about or asking them is what can we do better to recruit and retain people? What's going to work in Willmar, for example? What's going to work in the 9th District of Bemidji? What are some of the things we can do besides salary and benefits to make sure that we're meeting people's expectations so that they want to stay with us so we're not losing them at that 3 or 4 or 5 year period? We've done some other things. We're working with a class at UMD to redesign a brochure that we use when we're out recruiting. They're designing a brochure for us that's district specific, so it's going to highlight, let's say Duluth, for example. It's going to highlight what's available for folks if they're going to move to Duluth. We've tried to do some better use of social media. I will tell you, we've done some work with LinkedIn, which is very expensive to do, and the results, at least so far, have been underwhelming at best in terms of getting more people to interested in these positions. We're going to keep trying. We're going to keep doing that. So we're trying to think of some better ways to get out and recruit people, better ideas about how we're going to retain people. So, again, money is a big issue. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't. But part of it's on us to do a better job going out and recruiting and making a better environment for people to work in also.
Do you, Mr. Kier, do you guys send folks to the law schools when they have their little tabling days with firms and whatnot?
Mr. Chairman, we do. We're at the Minority Recruitment Fair. We're at the law schools. One of the things we're doing is sending our chiefs out to the law schools in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, places where you might have people who are more apt to want to apply for a job in, let's say, the Bemidji area or a Wilmer area or wherever. So we are doing that.
If I may, we also have the chiefs come down to the Twin City area for the three law schools here as part of the recruitment process. And for the last few years, at each one of those recruiting opportunities, the chiefs came down here as well. It wasn't just me standing there and talking to the folks. Right. There's another job fair, I believe, on either Thursday or Wednesday this week in Ramsey County.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the other piece of the request is a 5% increase each year for our public defense corporations. We talked a little bit about them in our overview. They handle roughly 3,300 to 3,500 cases a year that, but for the corporations, would be public defender cases. Finally, Mr. Chairman, there's a part of the request is $2 million for our cost sharing with Hennepin County. When this proposal was put into place, or this cost-sharing arrangement, I had hair, and most of it was dark. This has been a substantial issue over the last 20 years. How it worked is the legislature passed a cost-sharing arrangement between Hennepin and Ramsey County. It is the only county where there is that cost-sharing. At the same time, they grandfathered in the county employees in both Hennepin and Ramsey County with the idea that as of January 1st, 1999, all new hires would be state employees. There was an understanding at that time with that cost-sharing arrangement in Hennepin County that that was not sustainable for any length of time. As we said, there was would be a day of reckoning, and that day of reckoning has come. So when we started in 1999, there were no state employees in Hennepin County. We now have over 150. So as those vacancies occur, we have been funding those positions in Hennepin County and at the same time trying to maintain our part of the cost-sharing arrangement with Hennepin County. We just can't do it anymore, and we can't do it to the level that we have been doing it. So the request is $2 million a year to just maintain our relationship, our cost sharing with the county. Hennepin County still provides about $6 million a year to run that office, in addition to what we provide them and in addition to the personnel costs that we have with the state employees there. Again, I don't know if you want to take the time, Mr. Chairman, to go through that at this meeting, but we're happy to sit down and visit with any of you that want to individually about how that came about. All I can tell you, it was 2 o'clock in the morning and it was the last day of the legislative session. So I will leave it at that. So,
well, Mr. Guy, can you tell me how many county employees are left in Hennepin then?
Mr. Chairman, just off the top of my head, I would say there are roughly 40 in Hennepin, 43, something like that. And I believe in Ramsey, it's less than 20. I think it's probably 16 or 18, something like that. I can get you the exact number.
And what are those as a percentage of the whole staff ratio?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to look. You know, again, if we've got 40 employees and 150 in state employees in Hennepin, so we're talking about 25%, okay, something like that over there. I think it's less than Ramsey.
Okay. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, just wondering, since you have both county and state employees in that office, are these paid at the state's rate of pay, or are these paid at the county's rate of pay?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, they are not. The county employees in Hennepin make considerably more than our state employees do. Depending on, you know, the where you are in seniority, probably $25,000 a year more. Some, maybe a little more than that at the top of the scale, or maybe closer to 30. So,
Chair Johnson.
It is a bone of contention, trust me.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, that's what I was getting at. We have the same people in the same office doing the same things, but because something this legislature did almost 20 years ago, it's making a mess of it. And I don't know how we can fix that.
Well, look around the table. Let's see. Chair Mariani was here back then, and I don't think so we could blame it all on him, but I don't think he was even on the committee back then. But I'm not familiar with the machination and politics of how that went down. I'm sure it had something to do with bargaining units and who came in and who didn't and everything. But, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a concern. And I do want to know more about it. Chair Johnson?
Yeah, I would like to know a lot more about it. We see a lot of, even in the school funding issues, where Hennepin, Ramsey, Minneapolis, St. Paul get treated totally different than the rest of the greater Minnesota.
Thank you. And you know, I would say, Chair Johnson, that some of this... You know, I don't know what my opinion about it would have been at the time. I'm sure in order to make this happen and the whole switchover, because various aspects of the court system have all switched over the course of the last 30 years, including the judges, you know, who's getting paid from the state instead of who's getting paid from the counties, because it all used to be from the counties. And so this was just a holdover, and I'm sure there are probably holdovers in some other areas, too, that maybe hopefully we don't have to deal with. Go ahead, Mr. Kier. Oh, Chair Constantine has a question.
No, actually, I have a comment. I mean, this is the core problem with the system as far as inequality, and it is the poor versus people with means in front of the court, and this is right where it's at. If we're going to actually say that we want an equal system statewide, we have to address this before we do anything else. I mean, this is where the inequity lies. Thank you.
Let me ask you this, and Chair Liebling has a comment or question too. But are we seeing these when you first said that the number of county employees we have in Hennepin and Ramsey, and then a few pages back you had the problem with the number of resignations at 5 years of service. Are people sticking around in Hennepin and Ramsey because they make a chunk of change over?
Mr. Chairman, no. In fact, Hennepin County had the most resignations last year. So that the resignations are the problem with resignations are statewide.
But that wasn't from the. I'm assuming maybe it wasn't from the grandfathered in county employees.
Mr. Chairman, no. Those are all retirements by and large. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to get into this because of Chair Johnson's comment, and maybe I'm misunderstanding this, and please straighten me out if I am, but I thought what you were talking about here is not that Hennepin County gets some extra benefit, but that they're actually paying for part of the system out of their, I assume, out of their property tax, and that these extra county employees who are still on the county payroll are getting paid extra because that's county money. So, you know, let me know if I'm correct here, but it seems like this is a case where the county is doing more, not getting an extra benefit, but actually, you know, putting in more than the state is, than otherwise they would have done. Am I understanding that right?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. So, They are putting property tax. Hennepin County is putting property tax dollars into the office to the tune of, as I said, somewhere around $6 million. Those employees that are county employees have a totally different personnel system, totally different collective bargaining system. So that's how. Right. That's why that is.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could also comment, that's part of the issue, right? Is some counties are addressing the issue of the criminal court system in a better way. And one of the concerns that our folks have is pay parity. So our folks in Hennepin County, the pay parity is substantially less than what the Hennepin County employees make. You know, attorney generals make more money than our public defenders make. You know, name your county. That's part of the issue that we're trying to address with this budget request.
Thank you. And we'll – this is the last slide, I know, members. We have two more folks who are going to testify. We've got Teamsters, Local 320, Jason Alexander, the assistant PD in the night. So if you have any further questions, please hold those off until we hear from the other two testifiers, because we'd like to wrap up in about 10 minutes. Any closing comments?
No. Chairman, okay. No. Except thank you again for the support and all of you as we've visited with you. We appreciate the support, and hopefully as we go forward, we can address these issues.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Brian Aldis. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I'm Brian Aldis, the principal officer and secretary treasurer of Teamsters Local 320, and this is Justin Alexander, who is an assistant district public defender from the 9th Judicial District out of Brainerd. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as the secretary treasurer and principal officer of Teamsters Local 320, the labor union, which represents nearly 700 attorneys and support staff at the Minnesota Board of Public Defense, I'm here to state our union's, Teamsters Local 320, unequivocal support for the Board of Public Defense's 2020-2021 budget request. The state public defenders organized with the Teamsters back in 1999. In part as a way to create salary and benefit equity with their state and local prosecutor counterparts. We were successful in that endeavor up until the Great Recession of 2008. Wage freezes, budget cuts resulted in the board becoming uncompetitive with state and local prosecutors, as you heard in Mr. Kyer and Mr. Ward's testimony and presentation. I would like to stress how significant this budget request for reward and retention for seasoned assistant public defenders is, as well as a means to attract qualified candidates to fill the vacant positions. Without seasoned attorneys, justice is delayed, and denying the constitutional right to proper representation harms both the accused and the communities at large. I would like to now introduce Justin Alexander, who, as I mentioned earlier, is an assistant public defender in the 9th Judicial District. When Justin has concluded his remarks, we're open for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jessen Alexander. I'm a public assistant public defender in the 9th Judicial District. I work out of the Brainerd office. I started my career in the Crookston office. I've been doing this job for about 5.5 years, and both, as Mr. Kyer and Mr. Ward touched on, we do have a retention problem in the state, and we do have a retention problem particularly in the 9th. My position opened up in Crookston. Before I took that position, there had been a longtime public defender who had been up there for many years, and he ended up taking a position as a county attorney in Red Lake County, making substantially more money. And since I left the Crookston office a few years ago, my position has turned over two, and now it's going to be filled for a third time since I left about 2.5 years ago. And both of those attorneys, one most recently went to Grand Forks County in North Dakota to make $10,000 more a year, and the other one left for Beltrami County Attorney's Office, I believe, and he was making somewhere around $20,000 more a year. This is a problem that we need to address, just as everybody's pointed out, and I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd feel free to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Alexander and Mr. Aldis. Questions from members of the committee? Well, we appreciate your support of the public defender's budget unequivocally as stated, and we'll look forward to working with you when it comes around time between now and markup in the next couple of months. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank yourself and members of the committee. Thank you.
Members, so that are there any other members of the public who wish to be heard on the presentation of the public defender's budget? I don't see any. Any questions or comments from members of the committee on this? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, I was just wondering if the public defender's office could give the total dollar amount over base that they're requesting.
Did you hear the
yeah,
question then,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Carr, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the budget request is $10 million the first year, $21 million the second year. The annual budget for this year is about $88 million.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. Say that number again, Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman, $88 million is the annual budget, so this year is about $88 million. We're asking for an increase for next year of $10 million
okay.
and $21 million in fiscal year 21.
Thank you. Chair Johnson, any other questions? Okay. Any other questions for members of the committee? Thank you again, Mr. Kier.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Ward, for presenting. Representative Olson, are you ready to roll on House File 400? Go ahead, get yourself and your testifier situated. We have a members. We have a new engrossment. I believe the engrossment in your packets was incorrect. So this is the third engrossment of House File 400 that has recently been passed out to you. This is the accurate presentation. And we have an amendment as well. Is this the A-19 amendment? Is this the liability amendment, Representative Olson?
Correct.
Okay. Does someone want to move Representative Olson's House File 400 for consideration? Representative Chair Liebling moves House File 400. And then we have the did you desire a member of the committee to offer the A-19 amendment, Representative Olson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, do we have a motion on the A-19 amendment to get Representative Olson's bill in the shape that she wants?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Noor moves the A-19 amendment. In order to get the bill in the shape that Representative Olson desires, any discussion on this?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering why we're removing the liability on this portion, particularly for the pharmacists when it is concerning around the non-opioid directives. Mm-hmm. And how would a pharmacist practically know that a person has made one of these arrangements with their doctor and so forth? If you can explain that for me, that would be really helpful. Thank
well,
you.
I'm not sure. Chair Scott, this has been the product of back and forth. So is there someone who you could call on to bring up here to explain that, Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. Yes, so it's not that we don't want to do something around liability. It's just that there were some conflicting approaches and some work that needs to be done outside of this. So I'd be happy to call on the folks that would like to speak to that.
Do you want to, Ms. Carlson, you want to come down? Or is there someone else we could have come down to speak to it? I would note, Chair Scott, that this isn't the first time this year we've had bills coming in asking for waivers of liability, or people want liability waived. I know that as long as I've chaired this committee, I've taken a dim view of folks who want to avoid their own liability. If I could waive all liability for anything I do, it'd be great too. So I look suspiciously at that. But could you speak to that, Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And the two liability provisions in the bill did raise red flag for us. And I want the committee to know that there really isn't anywhere in statute that we provide immunity or liability protection for professionals acting in their professional capacity. And these just seem to go quite a far path down from what we have done before. We have reporting immunity. We have acting in good faith immunity. This simply says that if you're acting on your own discretion and there's harm, you don't have civil or criminal or board liability, and we just have not provided that to any professional that I'm aware of in statute. And in talking with Representative Olson and others, not certain that lowering accountability in the issue of opioid prescription dispensing or for prescribing is an appropriate measure based on the serious problems that have been identified by the legislature and others.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I would like to hear from the bill's author as to how these pharmacists are supposed to know about a pre-existing non-opioid directive.
Well, I don't know if the author can answer.
Well, it's her bill, Mr. Chair. She should know the answer to that question. I think she knows that she has an answer.
Calm down. If you have an answer for it, Representative Olson, you can go ahead and answer, but I'm not going to make you speculate.
Thank you, Chair Lesh and Representative Scott. And I'd be happy to bring down Dr. Cody Weiberg from the Department of Pharmacy, who could also speak to this as well, and he also raised concerns on this portion as well. So if you'd like to hear from him, then I'd be happy to share as well. But I think the experts that are the ones that actually have to do the implementing of this would be important to hear from.
Sure, Mr. Weiberg, why don't you come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. Of the two liability pieces, the one we had the most concern about was actually not this one, although there's some concerns about that. We had a big concern at the board about the liability protections for the quantity limits. And the way that the language currently reads, and again, I think it could be worked on. I've actually offered some suggestions for about how it could be amended to address the board's concerns. But the concern we have is it basic this section of the law says that there's a 7-day limit on opioid prescriptions, but a pharmacist in pharmacy has no liability for disciplinary action, civil, criminal liability whatsoever, whether they fill the prescription or refuse to fill the prescription. And we strongly believe that pharmacists as professionals need to always practice using their best clinical judgment. And it really concerns two different ways. One is, I can give my wife as a brief example. She had a knee surgery replacement done several years ago. It went bad. She had to have it redone a year ago. There was significant scarring, and the doctor wrote a prescription for 10 days. It was completely clinically valid prescription, but a pharmacist under the original language in the bill could refuse to fill that prescription, and there was nothing the board could do about it, even though that would have been a clinically valid prescription. It could also go the other way. So the law says that there's a set, or the language says there's a 7-day limit, but allows a prescriber, using his or her professional judgment, to prescribe more. Well, so maybe the prescription is legally valid in terms of that it has all the legal requirements of a prescription, but what if it's for a very large quantity, much in excess of a 7-day supply, where it's clinically not appropriate? Again, the pharmacist could, under this provision, say, well, I just, you know, did what the doctor told me to, and we don't, you know, typically allow pharmacists to do that. So that was our primary concern. To the question about how would pharmacists know about directives, I believe, unless it's been taken out of there, there's, I think we're going to be required potentially to somehow, we have to work out the details, make that available through the prescription monitoring program so that they could actually look in the prescription monitoring program to see if one of those directives was available.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that language is not in this bill, Mr. Weiberg.
Is it no longer in?
It's not in this bill. And did Mr. Weiberg, did you check with the members, your members, about this change? Because this is the committee that deals with liability issues. That's one of the reasons this bill is here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very reluctant to vote for this amendment if the members of your organization have not signed off on this, especially without some sort of comfort language in there that says it's going to be part of the prescription monitoring program. I mean, that's very concerning. But this committee is here to deal with liability issues, and I don't see that language in here And so I likely will not be able to support this amendment because of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, the Bourque Pharmacy, of course, is the state agency that regulates pharmacists. We don't represent pharmacists, so if we did check with them, and the board members themselves have not seen this particular language. However, over the last several years, the board has had discussions in general about what sort of liability protections pharmacists should receive, and our job is to protect the public. And the board members in these discussions have really thought that these sort of very broad liability protections don't protect the public. So I'm confident that the members of the Board of Pharmacy would support striking this language.
Rep. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, Dr. Weiberg is correct. On lines 11.17 to 11.19, we do have the procedures to include the directive in the individual's medical record, the electronic health record, and to the extent practical to submit the directive to the prescription monitoring program database.
And so, Mr. Chair, thank you for that, and thank you for pointing that out. Does that speak directly to the, what are they calling these, the directives? Does that speak directly to the directives, the non-opioid directives?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, yes, this is within Article 3, Section 1, the Voluntary Non-Opioid Directive.
All right, thank you.
Okay, we're going to vote on the A-19 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Olson, two-year bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'm here with Representative Dave Baker, and as we all know, we are in the middle of an opioid addiction crisis. Parents have lost children, teachers have lost students, our first responders are asked to respond to impossible situations. No other family deserves to go through this, and Minnesotans expect us to take action enacting comprehensive treatment, prevention, and recovery strategies. While families, communities, and the state as a whole have paid significant prices during this opioid crisis, both in dollars and in tragic loss of life, House File 400 brings more of the actors in this crisis to invest in efforts around prevention, education, treatment, and recovery initiatives. So House File 400 builds off the bipartisan and bicameral work done last session, but sadly that did not move forward. And many of the provisions are not new to this bill, but build from what was brought forward last session. This bill has already been to numerous committees with more stops to come, and we've been having robust discussion to its many provisions, including the revenue source and appropriations. So as it pertains to the committee in front of us, Article 1, Section 6, Subdivision 5 sets up the opioid registration fee and requires the Board of Pharmacy to evaluate the registration fee on drug manufacturers and wholesalers, whether the fee has impacted prescribing practices. It allows the board to use data reported by dispensers through the prescription monitoring program. Article 3 also allows persons to execute a non-voluntary, no opioid directive, provides alternative methods to drug disposal, expands photo identification requires for purchase of controlled substance, place time limits on filling opioid prescriptions, establishes opioid quantity limits for treating acute pain associated with major trauma or surgical procedures, and requires continuing education on prescribing opioids and other controlled substances, including non-pharmacological alternatives for pain treatment and management. So regarding Article 3, we've already had robust discussion around the liability provisions that have been that we've covered with this amendment. And with that, I will turn it over to Representative Baker.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. Again, this is an important bill that still has a lot of stops to make. We are making this bill better as it goes along. This is one of the first in the country to kind of bring this robust conversation about some policy, some revenue opportunities here, but we want to make sure we get it right with the directive. So one of the things that we heard a lot of from folks was we need to put some limits in here. We need to put some options. Again, my personal story, when my son was sick and getting a surgery for his back, we also told the doctor, don't give us any opioids. My son has struggled with this. He still did. And it's been frustrating for many families to tell us that we ask not to, and they still do. If he was underage, which he wasn't at the time, again, a parent should be able to say, no, I don't want any of these pills in my home. This is pharmaceutical heroin. It's important that we understand the strength of these things. And if some families and loved ones are worried about this and tell the doctor directly not to do this, they should have that ability to do that. That's what part of this conversation and this language says. So with that, we'll keep it short, Mr. Chair, but I think this is an important part of this, having a voice at the table. People are needing a voice, but I also want to say this is an important part of medicine. We don't want to take this away from anybody who needs this, and this is our paramount message with Representative Olson and I, that we don't want to take that away, and we think this language cleans that up pretty good. So with that, thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Baker. Questions for the authors? I assume you want to have other people are going to be coming down to speak to this? You don't have anyone else? Okay. Representative Grassel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for both the authors, just my question is, have you gone to some of these generic manufacturers? Have you gone to tour some of the places to see the kind of constraints and restrictions and protocols and security measures that they have to take in the process of making these pills?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I personally have a visit scheduled tomorrow at a distributor center, but I think with the weather, that might have to be delayed. I have talked with other manufacturers, smaller ones in Minnesota, about their process in their order taking and how they control that. Although some items seem very tight and secure, there's other times when I'm questioning when alarming orders come in, what is the process there? I'm still quite honestly looking at that. But I will tell you, for the most part, our medical community is very concerned and has good protocol in place to make sure that this very powerful medicine is used properly and is maintained and controlled properly.
Representative Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Baker. The reason I'm saying that is because I've gone and toured the facility that is in Baudette, Minnesota, and it employs a couple hundred people there and so on. And the restrictions that are on them as far as manufacturing, I mean, they're monitored by the DEA. They have very strict requirements that they have to follow, and that they can only make what is given them as far as the allotment. This is the number that you can make. You have to keep track of every single one of these things. So I guess I'd like to have you, if both of you, to go and tour some of these facilities. I guess the reason I'm going to that is because some of the requirements what they may have to pay in the future, to try to keep in mind that this needs to be done right, and you've already said that, both of you have, and I trust that you're going to. But to keep in mind that these are also will also impact areas all around the state. I mean, there's several of these facilities in several of our representatives' districts from both sides, and they employ a lot of people. So to have undue pressure put upon them would be a result that I don't think either one of you are going for. I know there's things that need to be done. We need to get control of this, but we need to pointed in the direction of where are these bad actors? Where did this start? So that we don't harm those who have not been a part of the over distribution of this or the misuse of it.
Representative Baker.
Just a quick comment and back as well, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Grossel brings up a good point. Here's what I've learned from my tainted glasses is that a lot of people, a lot of companies, from a revenue standpoint, from a profit standpoint, enjoyed one heck of a bubble. And that bubble was a mistake. That bubble needs to be shrunk, and it is shrinking now because providers are doing a better job. And I think our world and our knowledge of this is doing much better. prescribing practices for opioids are going in the right direction, and they're getting much tighter. This should have been never to this level. And so for that, I think we're going to see some shrinkage, and that's a good thing in this case. Again, to not, though, to take it away from other folks, but we want to make sure that that was a artificial bubble in my mind, and I hope that that never happens again when it got released like it did. So I hear what you're saying, but nothing in this bill will hurt those folks doing the right job.
Other questions for the authors? Chair Johnson.
Chair Les, just more of a comment. I think Representative Baker hit the nail on the head on that one. We've come to a world now, and it's all over the place, where a pill will fix anything. There's a lot of old world remedies that actually work. But we've gone to have a pill to fix this, a pill to fix that. I think we need to take a good look at what we do and what we do to ourselves, looking for that magic here.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if either of the authors know. I know there have been multiple lawsuits against these manufacturers. And is there an update on any of those? I know Minnesota has one. I know several of our counties do. I'm not sure if cities do or not. But if either of the authors might have information on that.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I guess it's not really within. I mean, I could share that what was in the New York, you know, the litigation there is not included in this bill. So I think, and what the only part that we have in here that would touch anything regarding that is we talk about money recovered on behalf of a fund in the state. We have some making sure that the money that would come from any settlements on lines 2.11 through 2.14 would be deposited in the opioid stewardship account. So that's the parts that would be most relevant to what you're asking to this bill.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. Is there an expiration date for that opioid advisory council or the stewardship program? I guess it's the stewardship program because they're the ones that are going to be collecting the funds. Is that right?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, we had this conversation in GovOps when it was most relevant to that section of the bill is most relevant to the GovOps around the advisory council, and we'll have more discussion around the funding mechanisms when we get to HHS finance, I would assume, as well. So what we have in here is we have a robust reporting system. If you notice, there's dates tied to that the board will be issuing and getting reports so that we can monitor the progress, we can monitor what's happening around opioid usage in the state, the effectiveness of programs, with the idea that we'll be able to evaluate as we go.
Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this bill going to state gov finance since it's setting up this stewardship program? Is that the next stop for this bill?
I don't know. Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of what part of that would interact with state gov finance?
Well, you're...
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're setting up a stewardship program that's going to be receiving and allotting funds. I would think that that would come under state government finances.
Representative Olson.
Chair Leshen, we can talk more about that, but the fund itself, and maybe I could get technical assistance on that as well, wouldn't actually come through within the purview of what state government finance would oversee in particular.
Chair Scott, this is a separate fund. This would not be coming out of the general fund, right? It's passed through?
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, in Article 1, the statute that's cited there, 16A, that's MMB. That's MMB statute.
Okay. Well, I
just
guess maybe
something to think about. That I think probably this bill should probably travel there.
Take a look at it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the authors. Just not really within the purview of this committee, but we just added an amendment, and I just want to make a little brief comment about that, or maybe ask a question. The language that was inserted, I think, is good that you're kind of making a recognition that there are some people for whom opioids, arguably are necessary, that pain is a real thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little bit concerned, though, about this, of the language that was inserted, is to protect the ability of cancer patients, cancer survivors, others battling life-threatening illnesses who legitimately need prescription pain medications. I think that you know, I guess this would be a professional judgment kind of thing, but it's my understanding that there are other people, too, who legitimately need pain relief afforded by these kinds of medications, and I just have a bit of a concern that this language is maybe a bit too narrow, although I fully understand, you know, where the pendulum swings on these things, right? And we are at a point where we've gone, as Representative Baker said, way too far in one direction. And we really need to pull this back with recognition of how dangerous these medications are. But yet, you know, since we just added this, I just wanted to bring that up. We don't have to deal with it now. But, you know, I think as we go forward here, I hope that you'll give some further consideration to just tweaking that language and making sure that it meets the real realities of what patients need. Because I'm sure you've found out as you've carried this bill and gone along that, you know, there are people who really suffer from pain, and it is debilitating, and it, you know, and they may not have cancer. They may have something else. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Chair Liebling. Is there, and you don't have any testifiers, so I'm going to ask for anyone else who wants to come down and testify to the bill. Is there anyone else in the audience who is here to testify on House File 400 as amended today? Wow. Okay. Well, I thought we'd have a few more people. I know you both have done a lot of work, put a lot of work into this, so it's a testament to all that work that no one else wants to testify. I would note that we removed those liability provisions, members. It is the intent that if in some other committee, a committee that does not have jurisdiction over liability attempts to reinsert those, I will ask for the bill back. So Representative Liebling's motion. Any other commentary from members of the committee before we vote on the bill as amended? Representative O'Neill.
I apologize. I had to step up for a minute, and this may have been answered, but did they speak to the fact or clarify about taking up the liability portion and other instances where this is the same type of liability? In other words, they're held liable for prescribing. Not even sure how you would say it exactly, because if it's they're not prescribing what the prescription is, they can prescribe either more or less or something. Is there someplace else in statute that talks about liability and that's similar to what we're doing today? I'm just not sure, like, how similar or different it is that we're what we're holding the pharmacist accountable for. Is that similar or different, or is this done or not done? I apologize if that was already said. I may have missed it.
Well, I would note, Representative O'Neill, that from the chair's point of view, this was an effort to remove any liability. So whether or not an individual would be held liable under current law or under this bill as amended depends upon many, many other factors and many other hoops. So no one would be held liable per se going forward, you know, because we've removed the automatic dodging of liability in this, but I don't know if there's anyone else who can speak to that. Maybe research could speak to it if there's another section in statute, because I'm not sure. Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not familiar enough with Chapter 152, the Controlled Substances Chapter, to say definitively whether or not there's anything substantially similar to what was proposed in the third engrossment of the bill in other parts of that chapter. I can look and get back to members offline, though.
Okay, Ms. Carlson, did you want to speak to that, or Mr. Weiberg?
I just want to know what we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, we have the right to remain silent. Sometimes we lack the ability.
True, Mr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So, the way that health licensing boards in general have to deal with complaints, and we investigate at the Board of Pharmacy, 250 complaints a year. Licenses, professional licenses, because of a series of federal appellate court cases are considered property. And a state government agency can't take away someone's property without due process. And in our particular case, we have to prove allegations to a preponderance of evidence before we can take disciplinary action. So there are some protections built into the process so that licensing boards just can't automatically, you know, discipline someone at a drop of the hat. So there are those sorts of protections there. the problem that the board had with the language that was in the bill that's now been amended out is it would totally take away our ability to discipline pharmacists and pharmacies even when they were really grossly practicing outside of the standards of practice. But we do have a provision in both statutes and rules that says it's unprofessional conduct for a pharmacist to practice in a manner that very substantially deviates from the standard of practice most reasonable pharmacists would follow. And so I think there are due protections, due process protections built in, but the language as it was originally in the bill would essentially say that pharmacists and pharmacies for these particular situations could never be held accountable no matter what they did.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. That helps understand exactly what we're doing by removing that language. I just wasn't clear in reading through the amendment and striking the language kind of what we're left with, and so that does kind of help. I don't serve on the Health and Human Services Committee, so I'm not sure how those licensures work, but we do have to deal with liability here, so I just was curious as to, so if we strike that, sort of what are we left with, and what does it revert back to? So I appreciate that latitude.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Neal, the way I look at it, you know, when these liability stopgaps are, and just like around here, there are 1,000 ways to kill a bill, and really only one way to get through to pass one, you know. With the liability provision, there are still 1,000 ways to kill any potential grievance or lawsuit. You still got to be able to get it through. There are a lot of different stopgaps, from summary judgment to jurisdictional questions to just straight up getting the jury to overturn it, or jury to not award anything.
Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chairman, members, briefly, to answer at least part of your question, and I failed to mention this when I was up earlier, as it relates to your health care directive, which is on page 11 of the bill, that paragraph ends at the top of page 13, and I'd like the members to know that this doesn't alter an existing health care directive, and I think this is a health care directive when you voluntarily do not want an opioid prescribed. And you need to know that we've recognized in Minnesota health care directives in statute since 1993, and the immunities and liabilities for health care professionals are already contained in law. This is a health care directive, and it is, to get directly to your question, Representative, this is handled in other areas of law. In this instance, it's 145C, and you can see how they handle them, who directs them, what their liability is if they follow it, which is none, and what they can do when they don't want to follow that directive because of some other health care concerns. So we think that is already directed or already addressed in statute, and so I don't want you to walk away thinking that we've left this untouched. It is, we think, covered, and at best, if you needed to link up this healthcare directive to 145C in a different way through a statutory citation, I think that's all you really need to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Seeing none, then Chair Liebling's motion, right? That House File 400 be, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Representative Olson and Representative Baker. Members, tomorrow we will be receiving the Guardian Ad Litem budget request and hearing House File 13, which is a bill to amend the Constitution to provide for gender equality. Can I have you take your conversations outside the room, please? I know you want to talk about it because it was your bill. But if you could move outside the room before you start talking, I appreciate it. Thank you. Members, we'll be receiving the Guardian Ad Litem budget request and be hearing House File 13, which is a bill to amend the Constitution, provide for gender equality. Vice Chair Moeller will be chairing committee because I have a hearing up in Anoka County the judge wouldn't let me off for. So, yeah.
Let's see what poll you have.
Yeah, I have zero poll. Chair of the Judiciary Committee, but I still do what judges tell me to do. That there being no other business before the committee is adjourned.